So the topic for today is something that I don't really know very well how to present or talk about in this context. I was about 10 days ago, I was approached by Diana Lyons, who works for the Buddhist Peace Fellowship in terms of doing prison work, prison correspondence, prison bringing mindfulness and practice to prisoners. And she told me that this week and this weekend is a national weekend of faith in action on the death penalty. And all kinds of people around the country, all kinds of people of faith, different churches and synagogues and temples and stuff, are somehow addressing the issue of the death penalty, I think mostly with the idea of opposing it. And this was a movement or an initiative started by the Amnesty International. And so then she handed me this big packet of material and on this topic. And on one hand, I was really delighted with the idea of maybe talking about it. On the other hand, I'm not sure how to talk about it in the way that's appropriate for the kind of context we are. And even had thoughts about whether it's appropriate at all to bring it up. And that's for you to decide by the end of today. But I'm going to bring it up, so I guess I thought it was appropriate enough. One of the things I teach sometimes, especially in the intro class, introduction to mindfulness, that what makes a mindfulness or awareness sacred is when there's no outside. There's nothing which is considered unacceptable for awareness or something we exclude from awareness. We don't pay attention to it. And often people will divide their life into that which is acceptable and not acceptable. I noticed that even in myself doing this last sitting with you all, at some point in the sitting, I noticed that I was trying to accomplish something in the sitting. This morning, before coming here, a kind of Sangha member has given me a CD she's made for her children, but she's kind of passing it around now, of meditation she does for her children as she falls asleep. And so I've been doing it together with my little five-year-old son. And it's she teaches a meditation where you pay attention to stillness at the end of the out-breath, at the end of the in-breath, so you can get really still. So I just did that this morning with my son. We listened to the CD. And so I noticed I was sitting here trying to go for the still place and trying to make myself still that place and all the stuff. And it lasted for a few minutes, and then I noticed, wait a minute, this is not what's going on. I'm supposed to just, you know, be present for how things are, not trying to make something happen. So then I was present for how I was, and I actually felt a little bit awkward, a little bit, not anxious, not the right word, but concerned about this topic and what I might say. And so then I just made the mental note to myself, this. This is what's happening, as opposed to that. That's supposed to be happening. So even here, there's a kind of very subtle kind of bifurcation between, you know, paying attention to something and ignoring other things, excluding something, you know, in a sense, for something better or something other. And if that's kind of the spirit of Buddhist spirituality, that there's no outside for awareness what we pay attention to, then certainly some of the great tensions in our society, some of the great places of suffering and one of the fault lines of our culture are places we sometimes pay attention to also. We include that in awareness. I'm somewhat fond, in a maybe odd way, or I don't know, that we have this anti-abortion protest here on the street corner Thursday and Friday morning. If you've never been here Thursday and Friday morning, you should drive by and take a look and see what we have on our street corner. And the reason I'm fond of it is that the abortion issue is one of the great tensions in American culture, a great fault line, tremendous amount of tension, say the least, around it, hostility and to have it happen here on our street corner. Is to kind of, and you know, it's we include it in our awareness, something we include, we're mindful of. We can't, it's not just something we read in the newspaper, it's something distant, but it happens right here also. And so we include that in our awareness. So I'm fond of it in the sense that we include the tension in the scope of awareness of our center. So occasionally, I think, you know, to look at something like death penalty, which is also one of these great tensions in our society, is quite appropriate. It doesn't probably not going to leave any of you bouncing out of here inspired and you know filled with joy and delight and you know at wonderful spiritual truths and maybe some of you came here for that today. You felt kind of been a hard week and you come and get some inspirational talk and death penalty. Gee. So this idea of no outside, everything's included, the connotations for me, or the implications for me, that we try in Buddhist spirituality, in Buddhist practice, not to polarize issues, and not to see issues as black and white, as for and against, or them versus us. That doesn't mean that Buddhists don't have moral stands that they take, and clear ethical stands they take. But to avoid the kind of polarization that can happen of me versus you, or right and wrong. And so the question then is, how in mindfulness do we hold an issue like the death penalty and our views, opinions, and experiences of it in a way that's not polarizing, even though we might have clear opinions about what it is? And that's one of the reasons I was reluctant to bring up a topic like this at a center like ours, because it lends itself to very quickly in people's minds to polarization. And there was some, earlier this year, there was a teacher who came here who made a comment about George Bush that somehow implied that everyone here was, of course, against George Bush. And not everyone here is against George Bush. And so that person, I think, felt odd, you know, felt excluded. And then there was apparently some quite... I didn't read it, but I heard my interpretation of what I heard, a series of very intense communication on our kind of, on our whatever it's called, where people talk to each other on the email, about, they apparently escalated quite viciously around this, you know, George Bush and all this. And when I was in San Francisco Zen Center, Zen Center was living in kind of the inner city where there were these apparently these landlords who treated their slum tenants quite badly. And Zen Center was very careful when it got involved in the politics of the community not to do something that would alienate the landlords. And the rationale was the meditation hall that they had at the Zen Center should be a place where the landlords should also feel welcome to come meditate. That the meditation center, everyone should feel welcome, that that's not a polarizing place. But then we have real differences. And how, without polarizing, do we hold the differences and hold the views and hold the feelings in a way that feels appropriate for mindfulness? And my hope is that one of the contributions of Buddhism or mindfulness, a kind of thing, to American culture, is not necessarily an ability to solve problems, but very much an ability to hold what the problems are, what the tensions are, what the feelings are, in a way that's deeply respectful and allows for some deeper something to happen when there's deep listening and presence. Some years ago, periodically I have given talks related to the death penalty, usually when California is going to execute someone. And some years ago, when we were back at the Met of the Friends meeting house, we had one of these evenings. And there was some discussion. I don't really remember much of the discussion, what happened. However, partly because what followed kind of just has stayed with me ever since. So the discussion went on for a while, and maybe it felt a little bit academic. You know, people talked about their views and opinions and statistics about, you know, death penalty and how it works or doesn't work and all that. And then this fellow stood up, and he said... he found himself somewhat in a difficult position in being part of the discussion or whatever, because he found himself on both sides of the issue. Okay? And then he explained that his brother is on death row. And his brother is on death row for having killed his parents. So in both sides, you know, both the side of, you know, a person he loves, I suppose, his brother, his kin, you know, probably he doesn't want him to be killed. On the other hand, he killed his parents. And a sense of outrage or anger or maybe, I don't know, he didn't say how he felt, but you know, on both sides. How is it to be on both sides? And I don't think we had much more of a conversation after that. It's a little bit hard, you know, partly out of respect for him, you know, what's going on with him. And kind of this kind of authority when people suffer firsthand that way, where people talk, you know, we don't want to talk abstractly then. You know, if we haven't been touched in that kind of way ourselves. I think one of the times I talked about death penalty was around the time of Pauli Klaus. And I think maybe after Richard Davis was caught or he was sentenced or something. That was one of the times, there have been a few times since I've been a teacher that I've got all choked up and started crying a little bit. I couldn't talk in this role here. And that was, one of the times was in talking about that whole situation with Pauli Klaus. And we have this guy, Richard Davis, who was convicted of murdering this 12-year-old girl. And then he showed up at a sentencing hearing to be sentenced. And he showed no remorse at all for what he did. In fact, he was ready to kind of rub it in further, to cause more harm. And so he was given, I guess, some time to speak at his sentencing hearing before the sentencing. And he got up, and what I've read is he gave a rambling talk for about 5 minutes. And then he said that he did not sexually abuse the 12-year-old girl because she begged him, don't do what my father's done to me. So his father sitting there in the courtroom, right? And you know, at his sentencing hearing, he's accusing the father of having sexually molested his daughter, you know, the daughter. I mean, talk about rubbing it in. You know, he's killed the daughter. And so not many people in California had much sympathy for Richard Davis. And I think probably many people felt that he deserved to die, that someone like that does not deserve to live. And I know there are people in America who feel that certain people have given up their right to life. Being alive is a right that we can forfeit by our actions. And so I think that President Bush is one of those people. I think he said something pretty much that along those lines. So there are powerful feelings that come up, and there's, you know, people who've been, you know, family members or friends who've been survivors of murder, and they have their anger, their rage, their feeling of emptiness. That's, you know, how do you take care of that? And it's tremendous, the desire for revenge. And then you have people who have equally passionate feelings for their own reasons, very deeply embedded in their heart, wanting to prevent the death penalty, feeling that it's a travesty, and feeling quite convinced that there is very, very deep suffering in society at large and in individuals from the existence of something like death penalty in our country. And who's right? You know, what's the right way? Is it right to execute someone? Is it right to not execute someone? You know, what's right? And this, you know, this weekend is called the National Weekend of Faith in Action on the Death Penalty. And in my probably inadequate reflections on this kind of topic, my sense is that certain issues, ethical issues, like the death penalty, maybe like abortion, various things, that there is no ultimate authority, you know, unless you have one. I mean, like you have a God who provides it, or a book or Bible or something. But there is, you know, there is no ultimate authority for some of the fundamental ethical questions around death, life and death, except as articles of faith. And maybe some of you will disagree with me, and I'd love to hear that, but there's, you know, at some point it comes down to an article of faith. And article of faith rests on what? Does it rest on a book that we believe? Does it rest on some higher authority? Does it rest on legal laws? Does it rest logic, or does it rest on feelings, on the heart? Does it rest on understanding of how things work, you know, the cause and effect relationship and how things work in society at large? Do we do a cost-benefit analysis of the death penalty? Some people argue that they do that argument, and they argue that the cost-benefit analysis is heavily in favor of avoiding the death penalty. I read somewhere once that it costs something, I forget exactly now, but something in the order of $3 million for a state to execute someone. Well, it costs $600,000 to imprison someone for life. So that's a big disparity in terms of, you know, cost-benefit analysis, financially at least. And then there are people who pointed out that there's no evidence that death penalty has cut down on homicide rates in the states that have it. In fact, there's evidence that, if anything, that it's that the 8 months after death penalty, the homicide rate tends to go up slightly. So it could be a coincidence, but who knows? So maybe, is it in the end just an article of faith? I think the kind of cost-benefit analysis, you know, that's kind of a cold way of saying it, are quite convincing. In many reasons. You have, for example, Governor Ryan of Illinois, who used kind of an analysis like that when he realized that a lot of people on death row were falsely convicted. And so enough people were falsely convicted that he put up a moratorium on death penalties until this can be sorted out. I've read that it's in the last 30 years, over 110 people have been, falsely convicted is the right word, but more or less falsely convicted, ended up on death row, they shouldn't have been there. That's a lot of people. And so do we sacrifice the lives of some innocent people for people who are, you know, not innocent? So that kind of cost-benefit analysis exists. But one of the most powerful ones is the one that says that the pain in the heart of the surviving family members is so great that that somehow we have to take care of that pain. They deserve to have revenge. They deserve to be appeased. And like Mark Kloss said, you know, after Richard Davis, you know, kept driving home the pain over and over again and showing no remorse, his conclusion was the only way to have some closure from this was to have Richard Davis dead, because then he was going to keep kind of irritating the wound of suffering. And then there's people who argue, well, death penalty is one thing, but maybe it needs to be limited. Maybe the extent to which it's used is so great that in so many different situations that, you know, it's really inhumane. So, for example, United States, apparently, year 2000, the United States was one of four countries in the world that executed people who were under 18. And the other countries were China, the Congo, and Iran. No, maybe I'm wrong about that. Congo, Pakistan, and Iran, I think. And since then, the Congo and Pakistan have kind of changed their mind. I don't know what it means in the Congo, where they seem to have a lot of massacres. And so, what is it for the United States to have this, you know, laws that are willing to put juveniles to death? So what is it? What does Buddhism have to offer this? What does it have to do with Buddhist practice? I think one of the things is certainly to feel all this, to feel all the feelings and concerns and despair or anger or frustration in all directions, you know, for the other people, for the other views and all that, and how we feel. But also to feel our own, if we've also been the victim of crime or crime at that level. It happens even in small ways, you know, how we feel. This morning, just to come down here today, I got in my car to drive down here, and I noticed that my side view mirror was pushed back. Oh, so I got out of the car to push it, you know, snap it back. But it wasn't just pushed back, it had been broken. So I suppose some car drove by and knocked it down and broke it and just kept driving. And hit and run. So I'm a victim of hit and run this morning. You know, so how do I feel about that? I certainly had feelings that came up for me. So how do we feel? How do we sit with all this? And I think that the practices of mindfulness are really crucial. Because what mindfulness teaches us is a number of things. One is to hold the feelings, to learn how to hold feelings, no matter how beautiful or how difficult the feelings might be, how to hold them in an awareness which is not going to be reactive. That's not going to be swept up in reactivity. And why? Why is that useful? Because reactivity often gets into further trouble. Reactivity, in retrospect, often is situations where we wish we hadn't done that. By not being reactive, it gives us some space to allow wisdom and deeper understandings to surface. The movement towards revenge and the anger that can give rise to revenge is often arising out of feelings, out of emotions. And are there other ways of relating to our emotions than giving into them or speaking to, you know, kind of... And I'm sure there's arguments on both sides for the need for revenge, just from the side of view of family survivors. I know there are family survivors who have pointed out that revenge did nothing to them, to their pain. They thought it would, but after the death, the execution, they realized not much changed. And I can well imagine that there are people who said the opposite. It's the only way they had closure in a situation like that. But to hold the feelings and perhaps wait until the feelings of revenge have passed, until the feelings of anger have passed or been... no longer dominate, so that some other movement can occur. And are there other movements that can occur? And I think this is the other aspect that Buddhism has to teach, and that is that Buddhism teaches that the heart or the mind is a process and not a thing. And the heart and mind is malleable, it's changeable, it can be shaped, it's shapeable. And so how do we shape it? Do we take responsibility for shaping it? Do we help people in shaping their hearts and their minds? With the Pauli Klaus murder, there was probably many of you that her father, Mark Klaus, got very actively involved as an activist in this field in various ways. His mother took a very different route, and apparently she had a spiritual practice that's connected to ours. She'd been to Spirit Rock a little bit, and her response, I don't know if her only response, but in the months afterwards, she apparently was counseled quite a bit by Ram Dass, who came and worked with her. And you know, so it's kind of a very different approach, where she had the spiritual approach, where she tried to process and deal with this in a kind of spiritual way, in a personal way that way. And the father took it to a public arena as his way of responding to it. You know, both are probably, you know, appropriate in their own way. But there are different ways of doing it. So Buddhism teaches the malleability, the changeability of the human heart. And if we realize that, then what? If we take that into account, do we sit then and just take our feelings, whatever they be, as being fixed, as having fixed authority, this is the way they are? Or are there ways of working and developing and changing our how we are? It's been said that there are two big movements in Buddhist spirituality. One is letting go, and the other is the movement of development, of cultivating oneself. And in terms of ethics, there's the side of, in the precepts of Brahmani, which means to abstain, the side of abstaining from things. And then there's Bhavati, which means to cultivate oneself. And both those are very important parts of Buddhism. To only abstain, not cultivate oneself, is very limited kind of spiritual life. To only cultivate oneself and not abstain, perhaps, is also very limited and short-sighted. So to cultivate one, to cultivate one's capacity for compassion, to cultivate one's capacity for kindness, to cultivate one's capacity to let go of holding, of resentment, of fear, is part of what Buddhist spirituality has to offer. The most famous story that's given around on this topic from the Buddhist tradition is that of Angulimala, who was a mass murderer in the time of the Buddha. And the Buddha went into the forest to try to stop him from murdering his next victim. And then Angulimala decided, well, a Buddhist monk is defenseless, has no weapons, is committed to nonviolence. This is going to be an easy one. So he goes out to kill the Buddha. But the Buddha succeeds in convincing him otherwise. And rather than killing the Buddha, Angulimala becomes a disciple of the Buddha and becomes a monk. Shortly thereafter, the king, whose responsibility is the protection of the people in the kingdom, gathers together his army, big army, because Angulimala is considered to be quite dangerous, to go into the woods and to capture and kill Angulimala. And he comes to the Buddha, and who's living there in the woods, and he says to the Buddha, and the Buddha's sitting there he's sitting probably on the ground or whatever, and it must be a hot day in India because behind the Buddha is a monastic attendant, a monk, who has a big fan, and he's kind of fanning the Buddha, keeping him cool. And the king comes up to the Buddha and he says, I'm here in the woods to find Angulimala. Have you seen him? Do you have any idea where he is? And the Buddha says, let me ask you a question. If you had found out that Angulimala had given up his evil ways and instead had become a Buddhist monk, a renunciant, what would you do? And the king said, oh, in that case, I would leave him alone and probably I'd bow down to him in respect for what he's endeavoring to do. And then the Buddha says, oh, well, this monk behind me who's fanning me is Angulimala. At which point the king's, the description says, the king's hairs stood up. Probably out of fear. But then he kept his, basically his promise, and left Angulimala alone. So that's a very powerful image, you know, of a mass murderer being left alone because of, you know, becoming a renunciant, engaging himself in a spiritual life. We have in America a kind of separation of church and state. But we also in America don't have it in many ways. And one of the ways, in my view, I apologize for my view, but is that because America is a democracy where we elect our elected officials, that it isn't just like a king who's there, who's responsible for the protection of the people. Everybody, in a sense, in democracy is responsible indirectly. And so everybody has to make these very fundamental decisions in the electoral process. And so issues that are very fundamental, like that rely on faith issues, like abortion or death penalty and things like that, that people have to kind of fall back on, I think, on some very deep places within them, places of faith, places of deep knowing or understanding or whatever. And so in that, so because of that, the separation of church and state in America is not so powerful. Or maybe we say the separation between state and faith is not so absolute as people might want it. And so, in a sense, we all find ourselves in the position of the king. What do we do when we encounter someone who is genuinely trying to change him or herself in some of the most radical, fundamental ways a person can be changed? Is it possible to restore someone? Is it possible to create such a fundamental change of heart in human beings, in a human being, that no matter what their crime has been, that they can again become productive citizens or appropriate to be out in the world, or certainly not executed? And I think that's one of the things that Buddhism, over and over again, tries to teach, is that people can be changed. We can change in some deep way. There's another story from the discourses of a man who was sentenced to die. And he was being led through the city to his execution. And there was, I think it was a daughter of a very wealthy businessman, maybe the king, I don't know, of that town, on her balcony watching this man being led off to execution. And she falls in love with him. And so she begs her father to intervene and to stop the execution and let her marry him. So she's so adamant about this somehow, I don't know, that she succeeds in her wish. And the guy's forgiven, and he marries a daughter and becomes part of this wealthy family, I guess. And at some point, he realizes he has access to all this wealth and something. And so he decides he's going to, you know, take off with it. So he suggests to his wife to they'll go for a walk up to the mountains and go for a little pleasure walk. And they come to the edge of a cliff. And he's going to push her off the cliff. I guess his plan is to say that some tiger pushed her off or something. And he gets all the money and gets to go off. So here's someone who was saved from execution, only in a sense to be able to do a crime again. And but then she's a wise woman, and so she says, "Oh, dear husband, I'm weak. I can't defend myself. I know you're going to do this, but at least you know it's the important duty of a wife to always honor the husband. Before I die, can I at least honor you one last time? And to walk around you three times. Walking around something three times, clockwise in Buddhism, in Indian culture, is a way of showing respect. So let me walk around you three times, you know, to offer my respect one last time. Let me do this one thing before I die, to create good karma or whatever." So she starts walking around him. And when she's behind him, she pushes him off the cliff. And when the Buddha hears about this, he doesn't condone this kind of activity. He doesn't say, you know, this was a good thing that she did this or the right thing to do. But he does praise her for being a wise woman. And but it's quite a difference, you know, between Angulimala and this other guy. One has been engaged in a process of change, personal change, and the other wasn't involved in that change. So is it possible to change? Is it possible to help other people to change? I think what the Buddhist tradition has said down through the ages is that there's no guarantee that we can help other people change. But it's very dangerous to be involved in interrupting other people's karma, other people's opportunity for going through their own process of change and working on that. There have been periodic times in Buddhist history where the death penalty has been abolished in favor of things like, you know, life imprisonments or other things like that. So those two things, you know, I think what, you know, the kind of the offerings of Buddhism that somehow make sense for me to speak about today. One is to develop a wise capacity to hold our feelings, to hold our suffering, to not shut it down, but to learn how to work with it and open to it in a way that's helpful for everyone concerned. So that the wise action can come out of us. So that that part of us, if there is a part of us, that is moved to be compassionate or moved to develop our compassion, that part of ourselves which is moved to be changed ourselves, so we become a different kind of person, we become a better person or more that part of us, we can try to cultivate that, and our feelings and our emotions don't stand in the way of that. And the other thing that offering in Buddhism is this thing about change. The human heart can be changed. And in that the human heart can be changed, do we want to give people the opportunity to have that change? Is that something we want to do or not? So I think I've talked too long, and I probably talked too much about my opinions about this topic, which is very powerful for people. And I'm sure there are very diverse views and opinions here in this room. Maybe we can have a little bit of discussion now, and as you wish. But repeat myself maybe too many times, and I apologize. I hope we at least understand that that part of a Buddhist spiritual life is to open to what's there, to our feelings and our thoughts and our beliefs, and to examine them and look at them again and again and again. So what discussion do you have today? Yes, Kevin.
Couple of comments. First of all, I appreciate having some social sort of activism brought into the ideas or teachings of the stuff we're doing here. Otherwise, I haven't seen much of a connection with that here, and I appreciate that. Secondly, it reminds me of a story I heard, and I don't know if it's true, but some Native American culture, I heard a story recounted to me that stated that the worst criminals were given the supposed treatment of being loved the most. They were sort of set aside in a quarantined area as people who needed more love, almost special love, because they were probably suffering the most if they were to do these sort of unmindful things. And that's always sort of inspired me in a different perspective. I don't know if it's true, but I just wanted to make that.
Could you hear that? Yeah, yeah. Yes?
I have a question about karma. So for somebody like Mark Klass to actively pursue the death penalty for Davis, do you think that he incurs negative karma onto himself?
Ah. I think it's pretty clear that traditional Buddhist teachings would say that if someone has the intention to harm someone else, it intends harm on someone else, that's negative karma. And one of the Buddhist rationales, there's many Buddhist rationales against the death penalty, but one is that also for the sake of the executioner. The executioner creates tremendously bad karma that, you know, if you knew what it was causing the executioner karmically or psychically inside, you would never wish it on anyone to do that.
So you take that to the extreme, with somebody who just simply supports that family, incur negative karma?
Can we have another question, please? Yes.
Well, I would like to thank you. I actually feel some inspiration settling with my anxiety because I have the courage to do the best you can to bring up a potentially difficult subject and also to relate it to Buddhist principles that might
help me when I
can ever remember them. So I appreciate that very much.
Yes.
Not to intentionally try to complicate it too much, but considering the position of people in the military, soldiers who are on the front lines, by duty are given the responsibility of being the executioner, killing other people, and as we all know, frequently being given the orders to at times kill innocent people. And many of those soldiers having families, being parents, and then returning home and having to deal with their karma.
So the question of soldiers, and what about the ethical issues around killing and execution, or killing the soldiers and their karma, and their coming back and facing their families, and there's a whole series of issues there. When I was in Burma practicing with Upandita, I listened to a lot of his Dharma talks. Almost every, he gave talk almost every day. And one of the most common themes for his discussion, for that he came up periodically, was he would tell us stories of soldiers who came to meditate in his monastery. And he had people who came from both sides of the fighting in Burma. He had people who were the guerrillas fighting the government, and he had government soldiers fighting the guerrillas. And he would describe to me, how gruesome their activities had been. Some of them had tortured other people and killed people, and then they'd come to some point, they'd retire, or somehow, I don't know what they'd do, but they stop, and they would come to the monastery to meditate. And he would talk about how incredibly difficult it was for them to meditate. Because at some point in their meditation, they came to a level where they had to face the karma or the psychic imprints or the psychic resonance traces of what their actions had been. And he talked about how, he would talk very graphically about how difficult it was physically and emotionally, and how those people who saw it through, those ex-soldiers saw it through, would sit to the point of exploding. And at some point, they would explode, I guess, something, and then they would see it through, they'd break through to the other side, and to some other level of peace, or some breaking through what was going on in their psyche. But at least for some of those talks, he said, when he was talking about some of these individuals, he never really expected them to go beyond a certain level in their spiritual practice in this lifetime because of what they'd done. They could break through a certain level of the holding of the what was going on there, but they wouldn't be able to go much further or beyond a certain point. With Angulimala, he said he became an arhat, fully enlightened at some point. And then he went off into the village for alms, because Buddhist monks depend on the food of people who put food in their bowl. And so he's going off for alms. And the villagers recognize him as someone who's killed people, maybe in the village, that village itself. And so they start throwing rocks at him. And he comes back to the Buddha, to camp, to the monastery, all bruised. And so someone asks, or like the Buddha or something, and the Buddha explains that in fact Angulimala is fully liberated. His heart is free. There's no anger or fear or desire that grips his heart anymore. He's really free. However, he's not free of his past karma. And that still, he still has to live out some of the consequences of that. And therefore, the consequence, social karma, the social cause and effect is that, the people in the villages are still angry at him and afraid of him. And another place, so there's in the discourses, a soldier, sometimes translated as a professional soldier, comes to the Buddha and says, I come from a lineage of soldiers, and we teach that those people who die in battle go to a special heaven. For the battle-slain warriors. And you agree? And the Buddha says, don't ask that question. He asks again. That's the question. You shouldn't ask that question. Don't ask me that question. And he asks a third time. And see, when you ask a Buddha a third time, he has to answer. So he asks a third time, and so the Buddha says, okay, you asked for it. And he says, no, it's the opposite. That soldiers who die in battle, they go to a special hell called the hell of the slain soldiers. And there are, the rationale for that is that in order to die in battle, if you're fighting, you're wishing a harm on the other. And as long as you're wishing harm on another, you're creating very bad karma that then creates this kind of consequence. So are Buddhists is Buddhism then against war or against people serving in the military or being fighting wars like that? Historically, you don't find a lot of evidence of Buddhism speaking out against the kings, usually speaking kings down through the ages, arguing against them having standing armies. And there's no evidence that Buddha spoke out against the standing armies of his time. He didn't go to the kings and say, don't have armies. Indirectly, it seems to be what he was teaching. Not exactly that, but indirect pacifism and being peaceful and all that. But he didn't actually come out and make a public stand. You tend to see in Buddhism a kind of a recognition of there are different realms. And there's a kind of more spiritual side of life, and then there's a more side of politics or state. And that Buddhism has tended to overall, historically, stay out of the realm of the state. And that state has to, you know, state's responsible for protecting its citizens, and Buddhism will offer wise advice for that, but not, doesn't get too much involved. Really, it's the state, you know, soldiers, they have to do what they do. But, you know, Buddhist teachings are very clear that that's bad karma, and you wouldn't want to get close to that. But, you know, same time as that's the teachings, Buddhism doesn't want to say that or try to stop that or get in the way overall, is the impression I had. But I think that it all changes here in the West, because it's hard for me to imagine in a democratic society that it's as easy as it has been historically in the past to have this segregation between the state and faith, and, you know, a state and one's own personal conscience. And so I think we're asked in this modern world to face some of these issues in a way we haven't in the past. Yes?
The Chinese-American author Maxine Hong Kingston has just published a book that concerns Buddhist practice and war veterans, and it's called The Fifth Book of Peace.
Fifth Book of Peace.
When you were speaking, I was reminded of an experience that I had when the subject was first brought to my awareness, and it was in Plum Village, and I heard Sigma Han talking about what they call, what the Vietnamese call the American War, and how he was called to do something, to take some action. And he found that what was appropriate for him was to start with what we call the boat people. And he told the story of a woman who was on one of those boats to anywhere. There were over a million Vietnamese in this diaspora after our image there. And this one boat contained this one, she was a 15-year-old girl, and some pirates attacked the ship, and one of them raped this girl. And she jumped overboard to commit suicide. And either Vietnam himself was on the boat, or some people told him of the story, and he told us about how he reacted to that. And people were, of course, wanting this person punished, and I'm sure that there were people who advocated that he be executed himself. And that's when I first understood the connection about karma. And Sigma Han talked about how if this person is executed, that's the end of their ability to do any growing or changing. But to let this person sit with their own feelings and their own conscience for the rest of their natural lives is the thing that's going to get that person to think about it and change and perhaps change and perhaps grow. And isn't that what we really want to have happen? I was very, very touched by that and has stayed with me ever since. The idea that interfering in that way is not the most responsible thing one can do. That what we need to do is let their own karma do what it's doing in this life.
You?
So, you know, I've been teaching meditation class at Soledad Prison for 10 months now, and the class is about, we're teaching, this is a group of people, mostly in very worse Soledad and Santa Cruz, and there are about 100 prisoners that we're teaching, and I don't know in general what each of these people has done, but I know that they're there for several life sentences. There are definitely some murderers because they've acknowledged that. But this is a level 4 prison, so these people are not like likely in an urban gang situation. And they self-select out of this class, and most of these men are in their 40s and 50s, and have been in prison decades. My experience with these men is so touching, that the idea that we would execute them is inconceivable. And there's another side to this Ajahn Pasa that Abhigiri was asked to come and witness an execution of a Thai prisoner in Sacramento. And he went and they did in fact carry out that execution. And he said the experience of the trauma for all of the prisoners and guards was horrible.
Yes, last one, and then we'll stop.
I was remembering, as you were speaking, also a film of Thich Nhat Hanh's life, and he, at one point, was meeting with Vietnamese veterans, many of whom are having a great deal of difficulty living with themselves, and one of them said that he had never been able to be in the same room with children ever since he had been responsible for the deaths of 17 children during his term in Vietnam. And Thich Nhat Hanh basically said, forget those 17 children. And he gave the number of children who die every day of starvation. And he said, you can make a change. You can help the children of the world live. And that man did become a Buddhist monk himself and devoted his life to helping children survive. He raised his money to help them eat.
So it's a very emotional issue, all this, and I don't know who's here in the audience. Some of you I know, but I certainly, years ago when that fellow stood up and said he was on both sides of the issue, I had no idea that he was in the audience. He was in the group. So I don't know who is here and what level of feelings, of emotions, of history, of background this issue that anyone has here. And I certainly, ask for, forgiveness or something like that for bringing up a topic that maybe is very painful or difficult and divisive. And I hope that as we, that as practitioners of the Dharma, practitioners of mindfulness, that we really can dedicate ourselves to trying to find some way to live in the midst of very difficult issues in a way that's not divisive. That we find a way that no one is excluded from our hearts, regardless of what position they have or what they've done in their lives. Ajahn Chah once said, everything occurs within the heart. So do not have to have no outside, but to include everything is the spiritual direction of the Buddha's teachings. So thank you all very much.